Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today, we'll take a ride along the Hatfield and McCoy ATV trail system. Tourists who come to ride the ATV trails in southern West Virginia help support an ailing economy, but are they also helping to reignite an authentic sense of pride?
We don't really play off of the name, but what we want people to know is here we stick true to tradition.
And the Hatfield and McCoy feud is a story many Americans have heard of, but the real story is much more complicated. We'll hear why some descendants of the infamous Hatfield and McCoy family say it's time to take back the narrative.
A lot of people viewed us as uneducated people, savages, and that really has never been the case at all. People can call us whatever they want, but we've always been very proud people, very proud of our heritage and very proud of our home place.
That's up this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Sometimes when I say I'm from Appalachia, folks think they already have me figured out. Violent-natured, loves to fight, and ain't got no sense at all. Some historians believe a lot of these ideas and stereotypes come from media reports published years ago covering the Hatfield and McCoy feud. We know there's usually some truth buried within each stereotype, but these oversimplifications impose shallow, judgmental, shortcut understandings, cutting off the full picture of circumstances surrounding personal stories. So, on today's show, we're going to find out more about the Hatfield and McCoy feud, how it was reported, and explore long-term impacts the stories have on people. And we're going to start right on the Hatfield and McCoy ATV trail. It's an extensive trail system built out in a place where the job market has been hit hard by downturns in the coal industry. It's one way the region is attempting to pump new life back into the economy, using a familiar family feud name and ATVs to draw people to the region. The Hatfield and McCoy ATV trail system has been up and running in southern West Virginia since the early 2000s. Emily Allen reports.
On a Thursday morning at the Devil Ants Hatfield gravesite in Logan County, most people wouldn't expect to find anything other than gravestones with the last name Hatfield. Renee Simons and Eric Hartchuk from Texas hop off their four-wheeler to check out a dignified statue of Devil Ants himself.
We got to Man, what's today, Thursday?
Yeah.
We got to Man Wednesday, and
they're here for more than just West Virginia history. Simon says they saw a sign for the gravesite while riding the nearby Hatfield-McCoy trail system. It's a network of wooded, mountainous routes for ATV riding in southern West Virginia.
Where's that?
It's, in Texas, it's just, mud. You know, there's no hills, there's no, nothing like up here, and the colors up here are so pretty.
The trails are run by the Hatfield-McCoy Regional Recreation Authority. The group's executive director, Jeffrey Lusk, says the group chose to use the Hatfield-McCoy name based on an infamous feud of the late 1800s between two regional families.
We've taken what was maybe otherwise looked as a negative, you know, one of the largest family feuds in the country, and turned it into a positive, turned it into, you know, the most successful all-terrain vehicle trail system in the eastern U.S.
According to Lusk, the state sold roughly 50,000 permits to use the trails last year. This year, he anticipates the state will have sold 55,000. 85% will be sold to out-of-state riders. This influx of tourists, many of whom don't know much about the state, could mean big bucks for southern communities that have traditionally relied on a waning coal industry. In 2014, a Marshall University study showed tourists coming to use the Hatfield-McCoy trails spent around $22 million on local businesses in 2013. Lusk expects the number will double when Marshall University completes a new economic impact study in 2020. Right now, there are trailheads open in five southern counties: Mercer, McDowell, Wyoming, Mingo, and Logan.
You have to have enough property to do it. You have to have willing landowners. You have to have all the pieces have to line up just perfect to get one of these open. Thusly why, you know, after 19 years, you only have 8 systems and not 19. You can't build one of these every year.
But opening a trailhead isn't the automatic key to success. Lusk says communities need to match his organization's investment with local lodging and business development. The city of Welch in McDowell County has recently set out to become the most ATV-friendly community in West Virginia.
It's not an industry that we ever suspected that we would have, but now it's here, and we need to better facilitate what's needed for these tourists.
That's Jason Grubb, the recently hired business development specialist for the city of Welch.
Anywhere you go in this area, there's not a weekend that you don't come to Welch that you don't see ATVs running all over the highways, all over the mountains, at every local restaurant, at every place you could imagine. A lot of people consider that they may be the salvation for southern West Virginia by way of tourism.
Grubb says Welch started on its journey about 2 years ago when it passed an ordinance allowing ATVs on public roads. Many communities along the Hatfield-McCoy trails have done the same. Grubb says continued success relies on Welch connecting with its business community.
We need more restaurants here in order to facilitate places for them to eat, places for entertainment. We need more lodging in the area. It's something we've not had a lot of in the past. It used to in the 60s and 70s when coal was popular. There's a lot more lodging in the area. These days, there's not as much, but that's what we need more of in order to be able to accommodate the number of people that come in. It's a lot of residential areas, but not a lot of lodging for tourism.
Half an hour away in Pineville, Wyoming County, entrepreneurs left and right are opening cabins and homes to tourists with trail riding equipment. That includes Jill Hendricks. For the last 8.5 years, she's owned the Ole Jose Mexican Grill and Sports Bar. She estimates tourists make up more than half of her daily business during the 6 to 8 months when they're most active.
You know, as the riders were coming in, we just started being, realizing that there was such a need for lodging.
Hendricks has 3 houses, 2 of which are duplex models for visiting ATV riders in need of a place to stay. As a real estate agent, she says she has even sold a few vacation homes to out-of-staters.
We're probably, in our little county, we may be selling 4 or 5, maybe 6 a year, us personally.
Tourists have definitely helped buoy the local economy with their spending, but Hendricks says having outsiders come into these small towns can boost morale within the community.
Sometimes when you've lived in a place and been raised there, I think you become complacent, and also sometimes you can become a little negative, and then you see all these people coming in that are so positive, and then you start looking around and going, wait a minute, maybe it is a pretty cool place to live.
The Hatfield-McCoy Trails Regional Recreation Authority plans to open trailheads in 2 more southern counties this spring. Director Lusk says the authority is working to develop a second trail system spanning 5 more counties further north. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Emily Allen.
Emily is a Report for America Corps member. Today on Inside Appalachia, we're looking at how some communities in southern West Virginia are hoping to jumpstart their local economy through tourism. But what do we gain and what do we lose when we market ourselves to visitors? By branding southern West Virginia Hatfield and McCoy country, are we being true to our real identity or just reaffirming the image that outsiders have come to expect? The Hatfield and McCoy feud is full of bloodshed and revenge. A New York Times article in 1896 referred to the feud as frontier lawlessness and the Hatfield and McCoys as having an utter disregard of human life. The fact that the families got their income from illegal moonshining has also been used to discredit them as outlaws. For some, the feud has become synonymous with the type of mischaracterization of Appalachians that we'd like to leave behind. An episode of the PBS documentary TV show American Experience explores the complicated history surrounding the Hatfield and McCoy feud and the lasting impact it had on Appalachia's identity. Let's listen to a bit from the first part of the show. The first voice you'll hear is historian Charles Keeney.
I first learned about the Hatfield-McCoy feud from Bugs Bunny.
There are dear rabbit critters bound to be around here somewheres. On account of our seas, his footy print.
When I was a little kid, I saw a Bugs Bunny cartoon in which there were these two feuding mountaineer families.
Get him, pumpkin head.
The Hatfield and McCoy feud really created the stereotype of the hillbilly in the American popular consciousness. And it was this image of a simple-minded, violent, backward people.
There's a stereotype that these were toothless moonshine and hillbillies taking pot shots at one another. But it couldn't be further from the truth.
The Hatfield-McCoy feud is perhaps the most famous family conflict in American history. It has become a mythical tale of jealousy, rage, and revenge. Yet the events that took place near the end of the 19th century in central Appalachia are part of a much richer and more complex story. A story of a people's way of life slipping away and their struggle to adapt to forces far beyond their control.
The Hatfield-McCoy feud is much more than an Appalachian story. It's an American story.
One way to embrace all the radical changes that urbanism and industrialism were bringing was to define the rural as not just different, but in some ways dangerous and problematic.
We need to understand that sometimes the people telling the story about violence have as much of an agenda as the people who are acting out the violence in the first place.
What you really see is a story of the dark underbelly of industrialization and how industrialization impacted rural communities in America.
That was the voice of Charles Keeney, one of the historians featured in a new episode of PBS's American Experience about the Hatfield and McCoy feud. We also heard historians Robert Hutton, Anthony Harkins, Altina Waller, and Dean King. One concept that really stuck out to me was the idea that it can be more important to know the agenda of the person telling the story about the violence than the actual violence itself. I had a chance to talk more about this and other things with the writer of the documentary, Randall McLowry. We talked about why he wanted to work on The Feud, a project that tells the story behind such an infamous and controversial chapter in American history.
It's about a story, this iconic story that people may know of, have heard of, may know something about, but you know, often have heard about it, but really don't have much knowledge of it. So I think it was a real opportunity to uncover some of the myths that are around that story for a wider audience.
In watching the film, I think I remember hearing a historian talk about how, you know, these events that were happening and being highlighted by New York Times reporters and other reporters during this time, it seemed like events that would be pretty common to happen across the country or at least throughout that region.
There was a lot of violence happening at that time in the period 1880s and 1890s. It was a very violent period in American history. You had labor upheavals that were starting. You had cattle wars out in the Wild West, and you have, you know, the gunfight at the OK Corral. There's lots of violence happening in the South between, you know, against African Americans and through other parts of the country, and certainly violence against Native Americans. And I think what's important to look at and think about in terms of how the violence is being portrayed and being representative in Appalachia, as, for example, compared to something like what's going on in the Wild West, where in some ways it's romanticized in a way, not necessarily a positive spin, but it's presented in a way that is not negative in the way that the violence that happens, you know, with the Hatfield-McCoy feud, where it is really presenting these people as being these savages and uncivilized and backwards people.
Tell us why that was important to include in the film.
I think you have to be careful in terms of discussing whether this is some sort of conspiracy, which it is not. And I think what we look at in the story is that the violence was happening in the area, but there was also real interest in the area because of all the natural resources in central Appalachia. I mean, it was a hugely important area for the country at that time, and needing to get a railroad into southern West Virginia and to eastern Kentucky to be able to exploit the resources, especially coal. You had people that were living in this area, and they were seen, you know, especially an obstacle to progress. I mean, they wanted their land. They wanted the resources under their land. So in that respect, I think there was a way to position these people, and that was done through things like some of the reporting that was done, the first book that came out about the Hatfield-McCoy feud, An American Vendetta, you know, really positions to a large part is presenting these people and what was happening there as being barbaric. You know, this is a story of barbarism in America, and these people were sort of outside of civilization, and they needed to be changed.
What kind of impact do these kind of things have?
I'm not from Appalachia. I can't speak in from that perspective. But I do think that it is an area and a region that deals with, you know, very negative stereotypes about them. And so I think that that continues through to today. And the fact that this was something that really started with or was accelerated with what happened around the Hatfield-McCoy feud is that I think that is, you know, one of the real major legacies of this event in American history.
I think I noticed that there was a McCoy, a descendant of the McCoy, within this film, but I didn't notice any Hatfield descendants. Was there a reason for that, or did I miss something?
Well, you didn't miss anything, and it was not a specific reason. I think that we were looking to talk to descendants of, and we talked to many people, and I think that the reality is that, you know, Kim McCoy, who lives in Macar, Kentucky, but she actually was born in West Virginia, grew up in the area, is actually a Hatfield, and she is a direct descendant of one of Devil Lance's brothers, or Anderson Hatfield's brothers, and she married a McCoy, who is actually a direct descendant of one of Randolph McCoy's brothers, which, of course, you would not know that watching the film, so hopefully that doesn't potentially cause issues, feeling like he was somehow weighted one way or the other, but we really wanted to hear a voice from somebody who was connected to the story, and she was able to talk about the story from a perspective of somebody who has taken an interest in it and has learned about it, and beyond just things that have been handed down to her, and also lived in the area and could speak to the area.
What are your thoughts about some people within maybe Eastern Tennessee or even parts of Southern West Virginia and Appalachia who are really reclaiming this identity of what it means to be a redneck, or what it means to be a hillbilly, or what it means to be a mountaineer, and sort of taking ownership of it and making money from the national attention that's been drawn from it.
I think it's great in terms of taking ownership for your own history, your own culture. You know, I kind of, as Kim McCoy, who we recently talked about, at the end of the film, was that, you know, this is a place that people are very proud people, and they're proud of their heritage and proud of where they're from. And I've always found, in terms of my time in West Virginia, that it was a place where there was a real connection to the land, and the people were very rooted to this place. And I think that's something to be very proud of, and to have that sense of connection is something that I think a lot of people don't have, and I think it's important to celebrate that.
Thank you so much for bringing some of our stories here in Appalachia to the American experience. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's really been my pleasure.
Again, that was Randall McLowry, writer of a new episode of American Experience called The Feud. At the end of the show, there was a local descendant of the Hatfield and McCoy families, Kimberly McCoy, who basically got the last word. And here's what she said.
A lot of people viewed us as uneducated people, savages. And that really has never been the case at all. People can call us whatever they want, but we've always been very proud people, very proud of our heritage, and very proud of our home place.
So as we've been hearing, the Hatfield and McCoy family names are connected to a complicated history, one that some people would rather forget. Still, other people, including many of the descendants, say it's time to take back the story and reclaim the names. The Hatfield and McCoy ATV trail system that runs through southern West Virginia is just one example of how people are using the well-known history of the infamous feud to make money. Other businesses in southern West Virginia have also cropped up in recent years with the name, most of them catering to the trail riders. Spring, summer, and fall in Gilbert, West Virginia in Mingo County, most days you can find a barrage of ATVs rolling through town. Most of the riders are visiting for an adventurous vacation. The asphalt road runs are usually a short trip from their cabins or hotels to the woods onto the Hatfield and McCoy trail systems.
You come down here at any given time, you see 20 four-wheelers here, five over there, six, you know. Those people come in here to spend their money.
Chad Bishop is the master distiller in a nearby distillery. To get there, you have to drive up a steep hillside, and there's a sign out front that reads, "Reporters not allowed." The videographer I was working with was actually so spooked by that sign, he backed up into the hillside and suggested we leave. And like the trail system, the distillery's called, you guessed it, the Hatfield & McCoy Distillery. Most of the customers are ATV tourists.
When they come up my distillery, if they want a bottle of my product, they're getting the best money they can buy.
Chad takes a lot of pride in making moonshine. Well, technically it's whiskey, according to the Alcohol and Beverage Commission, but for Chad, the craft of brewing corn mash will always be moonshine. Chad says the recipe comes from the infamous William Anderson Devilance Hatfield himself. You see, Chad married into the family. His mother-in-law is Nancy Hatfield, the great-great-granddaughter of Devilance.
Chad's the main man at the distillery. He's my son-in-law.
Her father worked in the coal mines, but the boom and bust cycle meant he was often out of work.
Everybody was poor. We didn't know no better, you know. He had a tough life. Coal mining's hard. It's a hard life. We'd have starved to death if it meant for bootlegging back in the 50s.
Her daddy made moonshine with a radiator. She says today it'd take a lot longer if they had to make moonshine that way. But the moonshine tradition goes back even before the 50s, according to Nancy's mom, Billy Hatfield. Everybody calls her Granny Hatfield.
Back when I was 20 years old, we got married. And we moved to Bean Creek, a hole in the ground, one way in, one way out. And to make extra money, we made moonshine and sold it. And we hid it when he'd bring it out of the mountains. I would mix it in a bathtub. And I got pretty good on my 90 proof and all that. Back then, we made 90 proof and 100 proof, you know. And you had to watch your feds all the time because they were all the time after us. But we made moonshine, and that's how we made our extra money.
And today, the family business is legit, a registered tax-paying business that helps them make a living and stay in West Virginia. Owned by great-great-granddaughter Nancy Hatfield, with the son-in-law making the moonshine as the master distiller. In addition to the distillery, Nancy also runs a small lodging company that rents vacation cabins and hotel rooms to tourists. She doesn't mind sharing her family's story with visitors.
Oh, I enjoy talking to them. I talk to so many people, take so many pictures. I'm not famous or anything, but you know, but they always want a picture. I've took them in my pajamas out there on the porch, you know, with my hair up and everything. Because, you know, I can't go throw my clothes on when they come to the door. So I'm used to it, you know.
In a way, Nancy says she feels like she's reclaiming her family's name through her businesses and by telling these stories. Even though the family wasn't consulted before construction of the trail system that uses their name, both Chad and Nancy told me that the Hatfield & McCoy trail system has been great for business. Still, running a business that depends on tourists isn't profitable year-round.
There's only 7 months of business. The five, you don't have anything. It's dead for 5 months. And it's hard to come back after when you start back in March, 1st of April, because you have to spend all your money for the winter. That's the only downfall of it. It's so hard, you know. And God always makes a way. It's amazing, you know. You pray the power bills ain't gonna be too high, you know.
Just recently, Nancy's Moonshine Company won a long battle with producers in other states, such as Missouri and California, who were trying to use the name for their own brands of liquor.
That's one thing that I got what I wanted. You know, I want my name. I don't want anybody to have my name. It's not the real people. It's not fair.
Nancy and her company won the lawsuit, so now they get to keep the name Hatfield & McCoy Moonshine to label their liquor. Chad says, along with the Hatfield & McCoy Country Museum in Williamson, it's just one more way to bring another layer of authentic heritage to share with visitors.
Well, here you can come down here and go to a museum, and you can come here and watch whiskey being made in the mountains, you know, just like they did 150 years ago. So, yeah, I mean, they use the name, but I think if anybody's got the right to use it, it should be them.
After all, the craft and recipe for this liquor was developed and preserved in the backwoods of the West Virginia hills. So the only way for it to be authentic is to keep the name.
We don't really play off of the name, but we want what we want people to know is here we stick true to tradition. We're from the mountains. We make whiskey in the mountains. We do it all in the mountains.
And reclaiming their name for their business is also about taking back the narrative that has been told over the years, says Nancy. Ever since the feud, reports have traditionally focused on the fights and anger among the families.
I could write a book on our family. I couldn't tell you everything. It was Hatfields. Like I told you, the curse was handed down. You know, there's a lot of temperament. They have a lot of problem with forgiving. They can't forgive. It's sad.
While she admits that most of her family members have a bit of a temper, she's quick to point out that there's more to her family.
Hatfields are great people. My daddy would have given you the shirt off his back. I love my daddy. I was his sidekick, you know. Anything he told me to do, I'd do it. I mean, those things I did, I shouldn't have done. I should have been killed, you know. He bought me race cars. I raced them, you know. What was I going to do with Corvettes? I raced them. Camaros, you know. Daddy taught me all that, you know.
What else did he teach you?
He taught me there was a God. You know, he taught me, Nancy, don't let anybody ever tell you there's not a God, because there is. Not that he was so religious, you know, but he taught me that.
That was Nancy Hatfield talking about her daddy, Marcus Yule, and everybody called him Yule Hatfield. He taught her to make moonshine. Our associate producer, Eric Douglas, contributed to that story. Eric has been doing some of his own research, actually, into another Mingo County community that's become a destination for tourists, Matewan, West Virginia. We'll hear more about how the bloody Matewan Massacre, another dark page in southern West Virginia's history, is also being used to stoke tourism, help the economy, and yes, even is helping some people reclaim a positive personal sense of place. That's in the second half of Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Looking ahead to 2020, Inside Appalachia would like to get an idea of what's on your mind. Whether it's your feelings about recent teacher strikes, the decline of the coal industry, or other issues like abortion or LGBTQ rights. Maybe you'd like to weigh in on a congressional race, or even the impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump. Using your smartphone, send us a voice memo to tell us what's important to you. You can email it to us at insideappalachia@wvpublic.org by November 15th.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
You can tell them in the country, tell them in the town. The miners down in Mingo laid their shovels down. We won't pull another pillow. Another ton, or lift another finger till the union we have won. Stand up, boys, let the bosses know. Turn your buckets over, turn your lanterns low. There's fire in our hearts and fire in our soul, but there ain't gonna be no fire in the hole.
Next, we go to another town that's gotten a lot of national attention, Matewan, West Virginia. You might have heard of it because of the movie Matewan. The movie highlights the shootout that took place back in the 1920s between Baldwin Felt's detectives, who were hired by the coal company owners, and forces in the community who supported the striking miners. 10 people died. 7 of them were Baldwin Felt's detectives. And like the Hatfields and McCoy feud, the Matewan Massacre is a part of our history that was once taboo and a story often used to characterize Appalachians as lawless, violent, and rebellious. But now this southern West Virginia town is leaning into this labor history. Folks in Matewan have even built a museum dedicated to the mine wars, which might make a lot of sense. A recent study from the National Trust for Historic Preservation found that historic travel appeals to nearly 3 in 4 millennials, or people in their 20s and 30s. The Mine Wars Museum, which opened in 2015, draws about 1,500 visitors each summer, many from out of the state. Our associate producer, Eric Douglas, used to work at a small newspaper in Matewan. He returned to his old stomping grounds to see what changes the museum and the ATV tourists are making in the community of Matewan, and whether tourism is having any lasting impact on the local economy.
I was there from 1990 to 1991, and the two biggest stories I was reporting on at the time were the incoming flood wall that had not been built yet, but in reaction to a couple pretty devastating floods that hit the town. And the movie Matewan by John Sayles had just been released a couple years before. So that was still the buzz, and that was, everyone was talking about Matewan. And to build the flood wall, they literally had to raise part of the town that was outside of the flood wall and then reorient the way you entered the town. Previously, when you came into Matewan, you came under the train tracks and drove straight through the middle of town. So coal trucks and all the traffic went straight through the middle of downtown. Now, because of the flood wall, you actually go around behind the town and then enter basically backwards to the way it used to be. So it's really kind of refocused and reoriented the entire town the way it looks. When I was down there recently, I spoke with David Hatfield. He and his wife own a bed and breakfast in the town. Here's how he sees the changes that have come to his town because of the flood wall.
30 years ago, you had coal trucks running up down the street here because the main highway came right through the middle of Mate Street, which is the main street here in town. There were businesses that were geared around the coal industry. You had restaurants, you had clothing stores, you had all these typical small town retail businesses back then. Well, since the coal business has dried up steadily, then those businesses have dried up steadily. But when the flood wall was done, they moved the road, the main highway, back here on the other side of town. So it took the main flow of traffic out of the main street here in town. And they said that's what killed downtown Matewan. But I look at it as possibly being a blessing eventually if we could turn this into a tourist town and you could see the Matewan Massacre being redone here every day and we had small shops and a lot of people walking here in the streets. It's a blessing that that main traffic is now over there and we could have that foot traffic. So I think it really it is a blessing and we could turn it, we could use it that way.
Yeah, and one of the big moves is to focus on tourism across the state of West Virginia, and it seems like in lots of parts of Central Appalachia as well, and obviously Matewan has taken this approach as well. So this means that instead of bringing home fat salaries from mining coal, residents will have minimum wage type jobs, is my understanding, is the types of jobs that comes from the tourism industry.
I think it's got to help, I mean, versus no jobs at all. But it's really going to be impossible to replace those $70,000 to $100,000 a year coal jobs. I mean, they're at least with tourism jobs anyway. There's no way that tourism is ever going to bring in the kind of salaries that the coal industry ever did. One of the most interesting things to me was just the amount of, not Matewan itself, but in Mingo County, the coal jobs that have dropped off. You know, at one point there were 3,000 people or so working in coal mining, whether it was driving coal trucks or actively mining themselves. And that actually brought in $130 million in wages. That was about a third of all the jobs in the county were coal mining related, and more than half of the income, according to the government records. Today, there's about 1,300 people working in the coal mining industry, and for $107 million worth of income. The problem is 1991 dollars versus 2019 dollars, $130 million in 1991 is equal to about $245 million today. So the coal industry has almost dropped off half of the income level that it had at the time too. So it's really hurt the local economy.
It's decreased even more than what the numbers on the surface might indicate.
Exactly. Okay. It's interesting though, when I was there 30 years ago, the idea of tourism wasn't even on anybody's radar. I mean, there were a couple people talking about it, again, because of the movie Matewan and the Matewan Massacre.
And it is my understanding, to be fair, that while it might not replace some of the coal jobs, it's a way for the community to find ways to take pride mm-hmm. in where they live and fix things up so that not only tourists who visit for a week, but perhaps even businesses might be attracted to the region
sure.
and start more. Or, you know, and also entrepreneurship to start our own businesses.
There's a lot of people who are stepping up. David Hatfield that I mentioned earlier, and we'll hear from again, but he said there's four or five places within just a few miles of where he was in Matewan that are providing lodging services. Now, whether they're campgrounds or bed and breakfasts or just Airbnb type things, there's plenty of people who are coming up with new ways to give guided tours and to accommodate the riders for the ATV trails and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of different ways that people are trying to expand that. Here's David again. His bed and breakfast holds about 40 people, and most of them are there to visit or to ride the ATV trail system.
We've been happy with the results. Our business is steadily growing, and most of that is due to the trail system. So the Half of McCoy Trails is playing an integral part in the development of tourism here in the southern part of West Virginia.
That's interesting. So he sees the tourist dollars from the Hatfield-McCoy Trail system as a very positive thing. It's done well for him.
It has done well for him. He's not making huge amounts of money at this point, but he's doing okay. But at the same time, he recognizes that ATV tourism isn't going to save Mingo County or southern West Virginia. It's just not going to bring those same kind of jobs that coal once did.
The trail system is kind of like our respirator. We're on life support.
He thinks that the area needs to attract tourists who can ride the rivers, expand its tourism just beyond the four-wheeling, because not everyone's going to be able to do that. I spoke to a father and daughter who have West Virginia roots, but they actually have lived in Georgia, the daughter all her life, and the father grew up in Bluefield in that area, but had moved away 50 years ago. The father, Bill Powell, said he'd been planning this trip to West Virginia for some years now.
We came specifically to Matewan because I'd wanted to see the site of the origin of the Bloody Matewan business. We'll work our way back to Bramall, going to Colwood and some places like that, and then we've got to head back south tomorrow.
His daughter Gwen said she was reasonably surprised by what they found as they traveled to places in McDowell and Mingo counties, and she said she'd like to come back and stay longer.
We've enjoyed having all the different foods. We found an authentic Greek restaurant right there in the middle of Kimball.
Yes.
We pulled off and saw coal being taken out and put on the train cars, and have found abandoned cities. I mean, the city of Jaeger?
Yep. Jaeger, yeah.
Jaeger looks like literally a forgotten town that is, there's still a pocket here or there of people, but you could just see what has been. What was once a proud town has literally been forgotten.
So these are tourists who aren't there for the ATV trails. They came for the history.
Right. And as Gwen points out, there are some people out there who have some family connection to southern West Virginia and just want to learn more about the area.
There's so many people who have West Virginia roots. It's always amazing when I say that, you know, my dad's from West Virginia, all that, and whenever Country Roads comes on the radio, we're all singing out loud, and that slogan of Almost Heaven, I think there's a tenderness in the heart of anybody who has ever made a connection to West Virginia that can come to life on these heritage tours.
Actually, sitting on the front porch of David Hatfield's bed and breakfast, I sat down next to a gentleman named Rich Roach. Rich actually is from Hagerstown, Maryland, and he's been coming for the last 6 or 7 years now, comes to Matewan and spends a week and just enjoys the town. But he's not there for the Hatfields and McCoys trails either. He said he actually watched the movie Matewan back in 1987 and has been intrigued by the area ever since. Finally, just a few years ago, decided he was going to come to Matewan, so he and his wife picked up. And Rich said that they've had such a great experience in coming to Matewan into West Virginia that they come back every year for a week.
About 6 years ago, finally said, you know what, we're gonna hop in the car and we're gonna go down and spend a week down in the Matewan area and explore all that history. And then when we got down here, kind of got more interested in the Hatfields and McCoy component as well as the Matewan component.
That was Rich Roast, a tourist who spends a week each year in Matewan, West Virginia. Before that, I was speaking with our associate producer, Eric Douglas, who's been spending some time looking into the economic changes that have come to Matewan over the past 30 years. Some people say they wish there was more effort spent bringing in these heritage tourists, people like Mr. Roach. We asked one writer, Kimberly Collins, who grew up in Matewan, how she feels about the thousands of tourists who visit southern West Virginia.
My only issue with any of it is the hillbilly tourism. And I think that they're sticking that stereotype, that label on themselves that is, it's not fair. It's not fair to them. I would rather see something that is a little more, that draws a wider variety of people in for the history and the culture and art, real art. There are some amazing artists that I know that live there.
I think something she's saying there is interesting, that many of the tourists who visit southern West Virginia are only seeing the surface layer of the area without fully recognizing the layers of complicated history that have gone into misrepresenting our people. They might not even know, for example, that the term hillbilly is one that some Appalachians are embarrassed by or feel ashamed to be called redneck. As I mentioned, Collins grew up in Matewan, West Virginia, but now lives in Tennessee. Collins was so inspired by her hometown of Matewan that she wrote a novel about events that took place there nearly 100 years ago. Eric Douglas spoke with her by Skype about her new novel, Blood Creek, The Matewan Chronicles, which tells the Matewan tale from the perspective of women who lived through the mine wars.
Tell me about Blood Creek. Tell me what the story's about, but don't give away the ending, of course.
Okay. And it's so hard to talk about it without giving away all the good juicy details. So Blood Creek is the first in the Mingo Chronicles series, and I'm anticipating there will be three books total. And Blood Creek starts with the strike at Paint Creek and Cabin Creek, which took place in 1912. The story starts with a character named Ellie, and Ellie was a real person. The overarching theme of the book is the mine wars, and the thread that's kind of woven through the entire book, though, is the relationship of Ellie, her sister, and her cousin. So it's a book about relationships and just the fighting human spirit getting through some pretty dark, violent times in southern West Virginia.
Tell me why you started to approach this story from the female perspective.
So my cousin was telling me a couple of years ago some stories about her great-grandmother that I had never heard, that things that she went through after the Matewan massacre, which my great-grandfather was very involved in. And I knew in that moment that that was the story I needed to tell. And so the things that happened to her will come up in the next book in the series. But I just felt it was important to tell the women's stories because it's, you know, coal is it's a man's world. And the women really played a huge part in that. And I don't think that story is told enough, if at all.
So this is literally about your family or people that your family knew and interacted with in the day.
So Ellie was married to my brother-in-law's great-grandfather, Tom Chafin. And Tom is one of the main characters in the book. And I've really stuck to his story. So the massacre will continue with this same group of characters, but I'll be adding some of the characters that are related to me, my great-grandfather and great-grandmother and my great-uncles and a few other people. So it's a mixture of people that are directly related to me and a mixture of people that I know of.
A lot of people, when they think of the mine wars and whatever, they think of 1920. Why did you step back that previous decade?
Well, it wasn't my intention. When I started writing about the massacre in Matewan in 1920. And that was my focus. And I had actually never heard of Paint Creek and Cabin Creek. You know, there might have been just a blip on the history map growing up. But as I, when I discovered the story about Ellie and Tom, and I'm probably going to give some stuff away here, but Tom Chafin was married to Ellie. She was cheating on him with the police chief of Matewan. And so some things happened, and Tom ends up killing the police chief and the mayor. When I found that little tidbit buried in a book that I was doing for research on the massacre, I was fascinated with Ellie And so I wanted to tell that story, but that happened in 1911. And I thought, well, what the heck else was going on in 1911? Because I need to weave this in somehow. And so I started doing a lot more research, and I came upon the Paint Creek, Cabin Creek strike.
So you said the next one will be more about the, or 1920 and the Mate One massacre. But this is a trilogy then?
Yes. So this book, Blood Creek, is Paint Creek, Cabin Creek. The next book, The Massacre, obviously is, it will pick up where this book leaves off, but I'm not going to linger too much in those years in between. But the book is about the massacre and the things that happened there in Mate One, and all the things that happened after that. And then the third book will be about the Battle of Blair Mountain.
What did you personally learn from writing Blood Creek?
Writing this book and doing all the research, I realized that my heritage, my Appalachian heritage, is pretty amazing. And I'm more proud of it now than before I started writing this book, because I learned so much about the people of Appalachia and Southern West Virginia, and that they were hardworking and intelligent and smart and clever and really fighting for their rights, and that all those things that came before me have made me who I am today.
That was writer Kimberly Collins speaking with Eric Douglas. The remaining two books in the Mate One Chronicle series are set around the Mate One Massacre and the Battle of Blair Mountain. She expects her next book to be published next year. By the way, the Mine Wars Museum in Mate One explores several stories of the Mine Wars from the perspective of women. The museum is closed for the season, but in May, they plan to expand to a larger building in downtown Mate One, just in time for the 100th anniversary of the Mate One Massacre. Local actors from the community, as usual, will perform a reenactment of the Mate One shootout. So far today, we've heard about some of the ways towns across southern West Virginia are supporting their struggling economies by drawing people into their towns with familiar stories, and how that's pushing questions surrounding our identity forward. After all, with economic issues comes a host of other challenges for communities. Towns in this region are some of the worst hit by the drug epidemic. The small southern West Virginia town of Kermit, for example, has had more than its fair share of national headlines when it comes to the town's struggle with the opioid overdose crisis. But few stories focus on the people themselves. Reporter Emily Allen visited Kermit earlier this summer. For our last story, Emily joined up with a woman, Sister Therese Carew, who's trying to make lasting impacts on her community. As Carew told Emily, hope is possible where you least expect to find it.
Trains go through about every 20 minutes, so that's just a fact of life.
That's Sister Therese Carew. She's been in Kermit for about a decade, running Christian Help, a public charity that provides food, clothing, and free car rides in Kermit to the rest of Mingo County. Christian Help is located on the other side of those tracks that you hear, along the Tug River that separates West Virginia from Kentucky. Throughout town, there's patriotic decor and a few Christian-themed signs. There's also a few yard sale-like setups, where people are selling things like clothes and kids' toys.
Here's the local garage sale spot. This is pretty much always out.
Carew has come to know Kermit and its unincorporated communities better than most, just by driving people around. She and her staff give many rides to people who live on the outskirts of the Kermit area, in neighborhoods leading up to the mountain. She says the further from town you get, the poorer the homes start to look. There are a few really nice houses, with well-maintained driveways and statues of gold lions at the entrance. But there's even more mobile homes and small wooden structures.
There's no zoning, so the properties, you can have a $250,000 home like on this curve, and then across the street could be a trailer.
A lot of the people Carew helps don't have their own vehicles.
And I just took a man home up a gravel road up here I had never been on before, but he was walking with like 8 bags of groceries over in Moorfield. Because it was like 10 o'clock in the morning and already like 90 degrees, and he just looked like he was dying trying to walk and carry his groceries. So I just stopped and said, I'm Sister Trace from Christian Health. Can I give you a ride?
It's harder to walk to some of the larger grocery stores and medical centers, the closest of which are located half an hour south by car in Williamson.
When I was a kid, we could walk 3 blocks and get to the drugstore in town, which was the pharmacy, but it was also like had cards and toiletries and stuff in it, kind of the prelude to the mini market, and it had a candy counter, so you could get your 10-cent allowance and you could walk and go get your candy, or say you wanted a pop or something. You know, it's, there's no bowling alleys. You haven't seen the mini mart to go buy a popsicle and a pop on a summer day. There's just nothing.
Like we said earlier, Sister Therese Carew runs Christian Help in Kermit, but she doesn't do it alone. Carew works with a staff of about 8, and that includes Etta Lee Kaiser, a mother and a Kermit native.
This would just always be home to me, always. I guess for good or bad, or it's just home.
About 20 years ago, Kaiser developed an addiction to opioids. Most recently, she's been in recovery for 2 years. As hard of a time as she's had with substance use disorder and recovery in this town, she says she likes that her friends and neighbors know her and know her story.
I love the fact that it is a small community because you kind of know everybody, and if you don't know everybody, you at least know a family member.
A lot has changed since Kaiser was a kid in Kermit. Businesses have left. Many of the coal jobs that supported the families in the area are gone, and nothing came to replace them. More people are using more drugs.
And it's just sad. It's just sad to watch people's life, I mean, just being destroyed, and there's no help.
Kaiser says she stayed because she likes how familiar everything is, and she can use her experiences with recovery to make a difference in her community. Kaiser says she's a certified recovery coach, and she's training to be a licensed peer support specialist. That means she'll be able to connect more people dealing with substance use disorder to treatment.
For addicts to be able to talk and feel safe and not judged and trusted by a peer, that's a safe space.
Kaiser says she believes sharing her experience will bring awareness to the issue and encourage others to share their own stories.
You know, I have a daughter, and I want her to say, no matter what mistakes you make, you can always start over. No matter what, you can always start over.
That was Etta Lee Kaiser from Kermit, West Virginia, speaking with Report for America Corps member Emily Allen. So today, we've explored several ways people are trying to reclaim their own story, and our livelihood is at least a part of that identity. Yeah, we have some grim realities here, but we also have people who are finding solutions and making changes. There's no lack of work to be done. Economic hardship, apathy, loneliness, addiction. But Appalachia is home to some really creative and extremely resourceful people. As we heard, tourism alone can't fix Central Appalachia's problems, but it can help bring new energy and people into our communities. And while visitors bring their own sorts of problems too, I'd like to believe that they also bring opportunities to glean insight into other places and perspectives. I'd also like to believe that as we become better at telling our own story, other people will begin to understand us better too. Till next time, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. Other music this week was provided by Dinosaur Burps and Hazel Dickens. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Glynis Board edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org/insideappalachia to sign up for the Inside Appalachia newsletter. There you can also subscribe or download all of our stories or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.